patients died. Take a look at the second study here about severe malaria. This was a study that was conducted with 251 children. And of those who were diagnosed with malaria, 73% had positive smears. And of those who had positive malaria smears, 12% also had bacterial blood tract infections, bacteremia. But interestingly, of those diagnosed with severe malaria who did not have a positive malaria smear, in other words, they did not have malaria at all, 40% of them had bacterial bloodstream infection, bacteremia. And every one of those kids was treated with drugs for malaria, which means that of those children who were smear negative, 39% died. And only 9% of those who actually had malaria died. So the bottom line here is, if you had the right diagnosis, you could prevent the deaths of many people in the developing world. And what was the reason that these doctors failed to take advantage of the laboratory test capacity that might have been there? Well, the biggest reason was that they said the laboratory tests were too expensive. So instead, they just empirically used antibiotics. Well, it turns out, of the 44% antibiotic use that was empirical, those antibiotics cost 5 to more than 20 times the amount of the laboratory test. So the physician's whole reason for making that decision was actually not based in fact. So what is the value of a routine diagnostic microlab? You might not even be thinking about this anymore because it has become such a normal part of our lives here. But first of all, we can manage individual patient cases. We can make a diagnosis and pinpoint the correct organism to treat for bloodstream infections, pneumonia, wound infections, meningitis, diarrhea, and UTIs. And if you don't have a microbiology laboratory, you cannot pinpoint either the source of the infectious disease or the agent, and you certainly aren't going to be able to choose the right antimicrobial agent to treat it. You can also detect emerging resistance to antibiotics and prevent the spread of resistance by imposing correct infection control practices, etc. I will come back to this detect emerging resistance in a moment, so just keep that in your mind. Hospital infection control. Early detection of microbial pathogens with public health importance. Our laboratory in Kampon Cham, 2 years ago, identified 90 cases of Vibrio cholera. That's on the Mekong River, north of Phnom Penh. For sure, that cholera was coming down into Phnom Penh and being transferred to many patients. But if our laboratory had not been there, nobody would have known there was cholera. And I might add, the government of Cambodia refused to accept the information and only would call it diarrheal disease in all public communications, because if they accepted the fact that there was cholera in Cambodia, oh my God, they would have had to do something about it. So this is one of the problems with not having microbiology and not wanting to hear what the microbiologists say. Supportive outbreak investigations. But in developing world, laboratory microbiology is not trusted. This is a couple of pictures of two laboratories that I have visited and tried to train people in. One of them is in Botswana, the one on the top, and the one in the bottom is a laboratory in India, in Varanasi. These are their complete microbiology laboratories. Well, in developing world, the laboratories often do not actually deliver the correct results. Physicians learn to treat patients empirically because the results are not to be trusted. So they stop sending samples to microlab, and so the techs lose their original knowledge, if they had any. Their practice skills are lost. They spend their time doing other things, like chemistry. And so it becomes a very vicious circle that laboratories are not trusted, doctors don't send samples, labs don't do microbiology, and it disappears. I'll tell you a sort of a funny, sad story. I went to give a workshop in Lao in a town called Luang Prabang. I don't know if any of you have been to Luang Prabang. It is a marvelous little town north of in Lao, north of Vientiane, about 5 hours up the river. And I was told that the government had been informed and that the hospital was ready for me to go give the micro workshop, and that this was an excellent laboratory for me to go visit because they were doing microbiology. They'd been heavily supported by the Chinese government. There was a brand new Chinese hospital there. So we showed up at the hospital early in the morning, ready to do our workshop, assuming that they had heard we were coming. And first of all, they never heard we were coming. Second of all, they didn't have a lot of time because they were busy doing some chlamydia study for some drug company. But most importantly, we went, I said, oh, that's okay, you know. I'll get ready, we'll make some media, we'll incubate some plates overnight. I had brought organisms with me to do my workshop, and we'll start tomorrow, and show me the micro lab. So, by the way, I don't speak Lao. They don't speak English. I had an interpreter, but she only spoke French. So this was a lot of body language. So we went to the microbiology laboratory, and there was an empty room, a sink, and an incubator with the plug draped over the top of it. And I said, oh, why is the incubator not plugged in? And this is very typical. They said, well, the incubator broke 2 years ago, and nobody fixed it. I said, well, how do you do microbiology? And they said, what microbiology? So I went to the market, and I bought a light bulb, and I stuck it in the incubator, and I made plates. At the time, we had to bleed the humans because there were no other animals available, and just to show them how to make agar. And we made agar plates. I streaked them with my bugs. I incubated overnight with my light bulb, and in the morning, I opened it up, and my light bulb was too hot, and the plates had boiled over, and everything was like caked on the bottom of the incubator. So it took me a couple of days to figure out how to make that thing work. But thinking out of the box is very difficult. So this is a workshop that I gave in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, in about 1997. I was then a WHO expert trainer. And this is by explanation of how I got to doing what I'm doing today with regard to training in developing world. So we were training. It was an excellent workshop. Things were going really well. And I was asked some questions about some microbiology topics that were not part of the workshop. And off the top of my head, I didn't know the answer. But I said, I know the answers are in the ASM manual, because that was during the years I was editing the ASM manual. And Alex von Gravenitz, who's here in the audience, was one of my section editors. So I said, do you have one? Because this is the national Malaysian reference laboratory for the entire country. So I figured they must have one. And they said, oh yes, we have one. So we had to get a key to go to the director's office. We had to get a second key to open up the locked glass cabinet. And we pulled out the ASM manual that was about the previous edition, not the most recent. It had this much dust on it that we blew off, opened up the book. And this is what we see. Now, imagine that you are a Malaysian, and you learned English as a second language. And this is the book that you're supposed to go look up some stuff in. And when you learn English, or any language as a second language, you don't learn the alphabet, A, B, C, D, like that. And that's how the index works. So you can't use the index in a book of a language that you don't know. So how do you ever find anything? And the way we write things, my WHO training materials would say, they were teaching how to do a slide agglutination, and they said, you know, mix the organism with a stick and rock the slide gently. If you learn English as a second language, rock the slide sounds like take a rock maybe and bang. What are you thinking? So this was the eye-opening moment for me with regard to the training materials we were trying to use to train people who don't speak English as a second language. So I developed this benchtop microbiology training program on my sabbatical, as you heard from Becky. And it's a folder. It's got three sides. It folds up. It closes up with Velcro. And it's got clear plastic sleeves in it that hang, about 20 pages worth. So when you open it up, it looks like an easel like this. And I developed a series of flowcharts that were picture-based so that there weren't too many English words that you had to think about. And so it starts with sample handling and the main kinds of samples you get in the developing world, blood, pus, sputum, urine, etc. So there's a page for each kind of sample. So here's an example of a sputum page. And it talks about the sample and what you should do with it, gram stain, screen, look for pus cells, etc. Look for definitive organisms, plate it on what kind of plate, put a disc on it, put it in a, let's see, I hit the wrong button. Put it into a candle jar. You can use all kinds of things for candle jars. And then look for specific organisms. So that's an example of a sample collection page. Here's an example of an organism identification page in Khmer. This thing has now been translated into Chinese, Japanese, Khmer for Cambodia, Spanish, Portuguese, and French. So most anywhere you can use it. And it mainly is pictures. And people like it. And we can use it to train people. And then they can take it back to their own laboratories and use it right on their bench as their laboratory protocol. It's not English intensive. So you can see that I'm training in two totally different places. On the top there is in Cambodia or in 2008 or 2007, and here in Panama in 2011, and there it was in Spanish. Now, wherever we train, we use blood auger plates. Microbiology is dependent on blood auger plates, and in the developing world, we use either sheep or horse blood. And here you can see in a number of different settings, we always have to have blood auger plates. You couldn't really do clinical microbiology without a blood auger plate. Think about it. Why? Well, the nutrients are necessary for some species, like streptococci. The colony morphology was originally described on horse blood, and sheep blood is similar. And so we recognize colonies based on morphology and figure out what tests to do next to identify them based on what they look like on blood auger. And the hemolysis is extremely critical to allow initial organism characterization. If you didn't have hemolysis, you wouldn't recognize beta streps. They wouldn't be beta streps, etc. So we need this. But why do resource-poor areas have so many problems? Well, one of the main problems is, instead of using sheep or horse blood, it's too hot for sheep in most of those countries. And horses are too expensive. Nobody would bleed one for microbiology or stress one out like that if they had a horse, which they don't, for example, in many Southeast Asian countries. So they use human blood. Either they use outdated human blood bank blood from their own hospital, or they use their own blood, and it's free wherever you get it. So that's a key reason. Nobody wants to spend a dime to do anything when they don't have much money. And if you look at the wool sheep here in my picture, you'll see that they're very furry. And put that sheep into a 100-degree Cambodian household, and it would be very unhappy. So, but just take a look at these colonies side by side on human and sheep blood auger. So here's strep pyogenes on sheep, let's see, on sheep, and here it is on human. It doesn't look the same. It's teeny weeny pinpoint. After 2 days, you can barely see it. Here's Staph aureus, nice beta hemolytic on sheep blood auger. Here it is on citrated human blood auger, totally non-hemolytic. So human blood basically doesn't work. What happens to those old human blood bags from the blood bank that they don't get transfused? All these kinds of damages that you see here occur. And in addition to the fact that the blood cells are damaged, and so they won't appropriately react with the microbial hemolysins, blood in developing world can be unsafe. HIV, Hep B, Hep C, you really don't want to be pouring it around and filling it up into agar and making plates out of it. So we really want to discourage the use of human blood in developing world. And this is something I didn't know till we did this study, and that is that the blood cells themselves are different sized. So here you see citrated sheep blood. I'll tell you about hair sheep in a moment. Here's fresh human blood. The cells are about twice as big. And then here's outdated donor human blood on the right, and you see they're all crenated and funny looking, and clearly the hemolysins wouldn't react appropriately with them. So I believe the answer to this dilemma of having the appropriate blood in developing world is this breed of sheep called hair sheep. Maybe around here some of you know about hair sheep. Does anybody know that? Because some sheep breeders do use hair sheep. This is the original sheep. Humans bred sheep from this kind of sheep to have more and more of the wool stuff. But the original sheep had just a little bit of that wool stuff on top, and it falls off naturally in the summer. So they look kind of goat-like, only fatter. And they're much more docile. They're more sheep-like in behavior, so you can control them. So given that they have hair instead of wool, you don't need to shear them. And notice this particular side view here on the left of this sheep. See his little long tail? It looks kind of like the tail of a beagle to me. Now, our sheep in developed world with all the wool, you never see a long tail on them, right? We cut it off. Why do we cut it off? Because all that wool on that tail right next to where they poop, the poop goes in the wool gets contaminated with poop, flies come and lay their eggs in that thing, and the parasites get into the sheep and get into their bloodstream, or it gets secondarily infected with bacteria. So for wool sheep, you have to dock their tails. For hair sheep, you don't have to. They're parasite resistant, they're heat tolerant, and you could slaughter the babies to make lamb to sell. You could have a certain breed of hair sheep that you could milk and make sheep cheese. So these are a wonderful entrepreneurial activity for somebody in developing world. And by the way, you could be bleeding those sheep periodically and selling the blood to your local laboratory that they could use for microbiology. And I just want to show you the problems of sheep in Cambodia. So we have purchased, DMDP has purchased, We purchased 5 sheep, and you can see them in the upper left. This is what you can get in Cambodia. They're very bedraggled, but they do have wool, and it's kind of all matted and hideous. And we purchased 5, and within about a year and a half, we had 12. Who knew that sheep multiply like rabbits? I did not know that, but anyway, so you don't have to buy very many for developing world. But if you buy wool sheep like these guys, you have to shear them. Now, a guy in Cambodia does not know anything about how to shear a sheep. So it takes hours and hours. You can see it took 3 people. You can see the sheep being held down, and they're trying to shear them. At first, we only had scissors, so that took 6 hours. But we finally broke down and bought a shears from Australia. Those things cost $400. Who would have thought? But anyway, now you can see that we can shear a sheep in about an hour, and there's a lot of wool laying around when you're done, which, if you burn it, stinks like awful, and nothing else to do with it. Who's going to use wool in Cambodia, you know? So anyway, that is the problem with non-hair sheep. So I really am trying to get hair sheep in developing world. That's a mission I have not accomplished yet. But what we did do at Stanford with some of my postdocs and colleagues is we validated the fact that hair sheep blood worked great for all of microbiology, and this was published in PLOS One a couple of years ago. And what you see are, on the left, you see some camp tests that we did with defibrinated blood, citrated blood, and human blood. Or we did formal purchased sheep blood, which was defibrinated, and we bled the hare sheep, which happened to be handy in the neighborhood. There were hare sheep, hoodoo. And we did citrated and defibrinated. Citrated, bleeding them directly into a blood bank bag, just like we do for our human blood donors, only not the same volume. You wouldn't take a whole liter out of a sheep. But anyway, what you can see is that the penicillin E test works really great. The CAMP test works really great. Everything worked really great, and we published it. And so that opens the door for being able to use hare sheep and just bleeding them into a blood bank bag, which is much easier than doing the whole defibrination protocol that we used to have to do. And so that's still on my list of to-dos, is to get hare sheep into the developing world. But I want to talk just a little bit to you about DMDP, the Diagnostic Microdevelopment Program. That's our website. This is what you see on the first page if you go there. I urge you to go take a look at the blog if you're going to go there, and you'll see all the different activities that we've been doing over the years. And then there's a photo montage area. So if you click on photos here or projects, you will come down below and you'll see all the different people we work with and our training programs, etc. So Cambodia, it's one of the poorest countries in the world, and it has a huge young population, primarily because during the Pol Pot years, the government killed almost everybody who was over the age of 30. And if they wore glasses, they were thought to be an intellectual and either taken out to the countryside to be tortured or just killed outright. If they were a teacher, if they were a doctor, if they were anyone in a position of power, they were killed. And so what you have is a country full of young people who have never had any role models for how to behave with regard to other people, how to care about other people. Pol Pot, it was a very short reign, but it ended in all of our lifetime. And nobody forgets. And this is the only country in the world with rising mortality rate in children. And the government is still often... high government officials are former Pol Pot leaders. And I know you've heard about the tribunal going on in Cambodia now to try to bring some of these people to justice, but it's apparently a joke and it's not really happening. So I figure it'll be another two generations before the young people become leaders in their country. And the young people all understand about giving back, about the right of people to have good health. And so working with the people who are working in labs today, young doctors, young technicians, it's very gratifying, but it's very difficult because the government at the top is not supportive of NGO activities or work that's being done, despite the fact that there's a ton of sick people who need help. So our organization is working in four sites. Jim McLaughlin, a microbiologist, some of you may remember, is on the board of directors. And when I first visited Cambodia, he was working at the Ministry of Health as an advisor for microbiology. And so that is how we got interested in working in Cambodia to try and develop some laboratory capacity. When I first went there in the late 1990s, there was not one microbiology laboratory in the country that could do diagnosis for a bloodstream infection, for example, or meningitis, let alone pneumonia wounds, urinary tract infections, etc. And so we're working in four areas: Phnom Penh, the National Pediatric Hospital, Takeo, Kampuchea, and Battambang. And I'll tell you a little bit about those places. So when I was there in 2007 or 8, they were just demolishing this room here. And I taught my workshop in a room off this demolished room. This is the ceiling they were banging on. It was coming down onto the floor. And I'm teaching here. It was daytime, but all of a sudden the lights went out because electricity goes out in the developing world a lot. So somebody found a lamp. And the students were so excited, they didn't want to stop. So we kept on teaching in the dark. And it was a very gratifying time. And our organization got support from Foundation MIRU and WHO, and we've now developed in that space a very beautiful microbiology laboratory. So here's what the lab looks like today. And we have a teacher who'd gone there and do some teaching, and we have our first volunteer No, our second volunteer will be going next month, so this is really good news. Now, Camp on Sham is our poster child for a really terrific lab. So we opened this lab in 2009, and you see here Samari, Madame Samari. She's a pharmacist. All the microbiologists in Cambodia are pharmacists because they were all trained by the Pasteur Institute. So they don't know, actually, a lot of microbiology. But this is the place where we isolated the Vibrio cholera. We isolated one of the first Burkholderia pseudomallei. There's a ton of Burkholderia pseudomallei in Southeast Asia. They had never recognized it or isolated it until our laboratory got up and going. We used the WHONET program to produce antibiograms. And we've discovered in Cambodia an emerging pathogen called Streptococcus suis that causes meningitis. I'll talk about that a little bit more in a moment. And this was the very first place ever in Cambodia. And again, another patient diagnosed with cerebral malaria, treated for malaria. But here, because her laboratory has established its credibility, the physician actually sent a spinal fluid to the micro lab. The gram stain showed gram-positive cocci in pairs and short chains. Well, I, of course, thought it was strep pneumo. She wrote me that it was strep suis. And I wrote back, no, no, you're wrong. Or she said, it's not strep pneumo, is what she wrote. Because we teach them how to do strep pneumo, you know, opticon disc, bile solubility. Not strep pneumo. I said, no, you're wrong. Send it to NAMRU. NAMRU has been a wonderful resource to identify. NAMRU sequenced it, and it was strep suis. So then I started to read up. At that time, there was only one other paper published about this emerging cause of meningitis in China associated with pigs. I'll tell you more in a minute. So, really interesting. So, we are teaching to the medical staff how to use the laboratory. It's been a very successful laboratory there. Here's our laboratory in Takeo. Angela Keown is a VITA volunteer from Australia. That's another group who provides volunteers to work in our laboratories. And this is another lab that we outfitted with money from BioMérieux and the World Health Organization. And Angela emailed me yesterday, and he says they have isolated 10 Burkholderia pseudomallei this year from blood sputumin wounds, 8 strep suis from spinal fluids, and I noticed that you had a talk, the Mickey King lecture a few years ago was Dan Shapiro talking about weird sexual interaction diseases. I don't know if some of you were here for that. Yeah. Well, this is a really weird behavior, too, that fits right in. And this is, okay, I have two weird behaviors to tell you, just as an aside. Did you read that there were a couple of cases of Campylobacter bacteremia in the United States from some guys in Texas? Yeah, do you read that? They were castrating sheep, so back to sheep, with their teeth. It's a macho thing to do, right? And who cared that the sheep had diarrhea? Right. I mean, tell me. Okay, so these Streptococcus suis, it's a big problem in Southeast China and spilling over into the other Asian countries. Because men go out and get drunk at night, and then they eat raw pig liver and pig kidneys. And that is how they acquire strep suis meningitis. So just for you to know. So here's a picture of a Burkholderia pseudomallei. In case any of you isolate it in your laboratories, it's a very distinctive colony, very wrinkly, gram-negative rod, bipolar staining, and smells like rotten potatoes. So you would know it immediately because of the smell. So here's what Angela sent me yesterday, is this picture of this woman. This is her back, and that is an abscess lesion that's kind of coming out from a hole. What do you think the organism is? You probably have no clue, right? Neither did he, and neither did the physicians in Takeo. They have never isolated before in the history of Cambodia a nocardia. This is a nocardia post-traumatic infection in the patient. So we had to tell them what drug to use, what dose to use, etc. And I'm happy to report that 2 days later she's doing much better. So lots of exciting things happening there. In November, I was asked to come and participate in the first ever workshop in Phnom Penh on the containment of antimicrobial resistance in Cambodia. why this is so exciting is because they would not have had enough information or laboratory participants or doctors who would know anything about emerging antibiotic resistance in Cambodia 2 years ago. So this is just amazing. And they have support now from the Antwerp Institute of Tropical Medicine and from the Sihanouk group, and a lot of NGOs are now working in Cambodia in different, supporting different hospital laboratories along with our group to do laboratory capacity building. So that was the good news, is they had a meeting to talk about resistance. Our laboratory, one of them, the National Pediatric Hospital, uses the WHONET also and reported, for example, 11 Klebsiella pneumoniae from bloodstream infections. This is percent susceptible. Imipenem is the only one that has a whole lot of activity, and it is what, like 70% of them are susceptible to imipenem. Look at the resistance rates of these antibiotics for Klebsiella pneumoniae. What I learned at that meeting was that the amount of high-level gram-negative rod resistance in Cambodia is probably the highest in the world. Because doctors don't trust their microlabs, they use any antibiotic they feel like, they can buy it over the counter, it comes from India without any quality control, it's stored at 80 degrees so it loses potency. All these reasons make these places a hotbed of resistance. Okay, so I'm going to kind of wrap up here with things you need to know when you go overseas to help develop a lab. So the first thing you need to do is go there first and figure out what they're doing, what they need. So what level of training do they have? Do they have any? And if they have it, did they learn a whole bunch of wrong things that they're still practicing that you have to stop before you can move on to right things? What kind of infrastructure do they have? Who's in charge? Politics is everything. The person who seems to be in charge may not really be the person in charge. You have to figure out who that is and bribe them. And I'm serious about this. And money is the only bribe. They don't really want gifts. You can take them out to lunch. That helps. But there's other things they want. You need to work with the nurses and the physicians and the hospital administrators to get their buy-in that they will work with you. You have to make daily checklists because people will not remember from one day to the next what they're supposed to do. And you need to be working. If you're a volunteer and you're sending volunteers somewhere, you can't have, you know how in microbiology in the United States, if you went into Jim Snyder's lab, he'd be doing something totally different from Amy, totally different from me, totally different from DeVise or Jerry. We each are absolutely sure we know what we're doing and it's right and we're not going to listen to anybody else. And all of what we're doing is right here. It's good enough. Over there, if you start telling different people different things, it is a disaster because they will try to do what you tell them and then the new volunteer comes and tells them something totally different. And it's really not good. You have to have a very simple SOP. Everybody has to be on the same page and you cannot deviate from that. You can't have people making their own SOPs. Improvisation must be discouraged. And you can have, most of these countries need to have a central countrywide protocol system that you help to develop and consistent and allay frustrations. And the next thing I want to say, and I think we should be doing it in this country more, I know some people are, is working with the local schools to make sure that what we practice in our labs is what they teach in the school. And so involve the teachers in your workshops and your training programs. Do you have teachers here at this meeting? I think you do, right? There is one. Involve the teachers. Keep them involved in what you're doing and what's up to date. And when you bring a volunteer into a laboratory, we have found that you need to leave a volunteer there for 2 years. A month is not enough. 6 months is not enough. 2 years is probably just barely enough in the developing world. It doesn't have to be the same person. You could have different people come over the two-year period as long as they're all following the same protocol. QC is a challenge. The concept of quality control is new to these people. But there are a lot of international organizations like the ASCP now, the American Public Health Lab people, who are beginning to set up quality management programs to help support some of these labs in developing world. Official indifference. The politics at the top is a problem. Low wages forces NGOs to incentivize. In Cambodia, we had to pay one technologist $2 US, that's like a day's wages, to read one AFB smear. Otherwise, they will not read it. They will hold it up to the light and say it's blue, negative, or whatever. Corruption is a big problem. The owner, every laboratory director in Cambodia who is a pharmacist, right, has their own pharmacy. And by the way, if you teach them how to do microbiology, they will take the richest patient samples to their own pharmacy laboratory and do them there and charge the patients there. You just have to learn to live with that. It is the only way that you're going to get cooperation back in their cheap day job where they don't make enough money to live. And the lack of training programs is a problem. So what do we need? What are our gaps? Funding from the Global Health and Security Initiative was our initial funding to help support some of these laboratories. That money is gone. Funding for continuing training, centralized media making facility. Actually, BioMérieux has now supported the preparation of blood broths for blood cultures at a central facility in Phnom Penh. So that's really exciting. We're just starting that. We have yet to find a donor to help us bring hair sheep into the developing world countries where we work. They're in Western Africa. They're the standard sheep in, like, Kenya. There's a lot of them. So we need to figure out a way to get them from Kenya to Cambodia. Anybody who knows anybody in the shipping industry or the airline industry who might want a public relations project, please see me later. But I do want to say something about DMDP and a final bit of good news. So we started in 2008 with funding from MERU and Global Health Initiative. We have set up these four laboratories now. They're functioning well. We have volunteers working there who are, we need more. I need volunteers who are willing to spend 6 months in a place. And it could be somewhere out in the middle of the boondocks, but I guarantee you it'll be very rewarding and fun and interesting. So anybody who knows anybody who's a bench tech, who really knows microbiology, who looks at a plate and knows what's there, who knows how to do quality control, and who would be interested in volunteering and living there for 6 months, wherever. It could be Cambodia or Myanmar or somewhere in Africa, Ethiopia, Laos, Vietnam, Pakistan. We need you. And World Health Organization has been very supportive. And here's my really hot, exciting news that I just learned, I hope. And that is that the Department of Defense, the Cooperative Biological Engagement Group, has heard from WHO in Cambodia that our NGO is the most successful with lab capacity building. And I think that we are in line to receive a whole bunch of funding. So that means instead of making our volunteers actually volunteer, we might be able to give them enough money to support their home while they're there in country working for us. So it's very exciting. I don't want to count my chickens before they hatch, but it's possible we could have real funding to carry on this activity and expand beyond Cambodia into some of these other countries where we've been asked to work. So, Alkun, thank you very much. I'm honored to be the Mickey King lecturer, and I hope Mickey would have approved of what's happening in Southeast Asia now. Thank you.